Are you looking to take your knowledge of Egypt to the next level? You've come to the right place. Welcome to Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt with your host, historian and Egyptology PhD grad from UCLA, Eric.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt. And today we're going to be talking about the Festival of Drunkenness. Now, the Festival of Drunkenness is a festival that occurred in ancient Egypt. We have some Greco-Roman sources that also mention it, but we also have sources that show that it goes back at least to the 18th dynasty, so New Kingdom Egypt, to the reign of Hatshepsut in particular. And this is a festival where it appears people would get just completely hammered, really, really drunk, possibly have sex in a communal environment as a way of celebrating some of the mythic kind of origins of ancient Egypt. And to be able to understand this, one of the things we actually need to do is kind of contextualize the setting in which this festival took place. Now, in ancient Egypt, we actually see there the first evidence really in the world for what might be thought of as theater. Although some might think of it or characterize it more as proto-theater or something like that. And basically what we see is that the ancient Egyptians would reenact in a festival environment some of their myths and stories. So they would, for instance, reenact the Osiris cycle, where he was killed, dismembered, reunited, and that would be part of a religious ceremony. In the Christian tradition, think about the passion plays that they have, where they would reenact the crucifixion of Jesus as part of what they would call this passion play. And those were especially popular in the medieval periods. That's the type of thing that we're talking about here. They would have these prominent myths that were seen as not just important in terms of being something that's entertaining, but something that's important on the cosmological level. And they would reenact them in these sacred spaces as part of a ritual. And it's something that then not only kind of reenacts that myth, but also is communal in nature. These are really participatory events. You know, we have evidence and texts from the Greco-Roman period that says, you know, that we have thousands of people involved in some of these. For instance, the Horus and Seth battles, the Tale of Osiris that I already mentioned, and then this one, the Festival of Drunkenness. So it seems that people would take place in these publicly in temples, but that they would also engage in versions of these or celebrations in their own homes with groups of people or perhaps in shrines, and that we have participation in these festivals from all levels of ancient Egyptian society. So, why would they have a festival of drunkenness? And before we get specifically into this festival, let's talk about the myth that inspired it. The myth that we have for this festival comes from the Book of the Heavenly Cow. And this is a New Kingdom book. So New Kingdom, again, we're at about 1550 or so to about the middle of the 11th century before the Common Era. This is really the kind of high point of ancient Egyptian society. It's the high point of the ancient Egyptian empire. It's where we have some of the most famous pharaohs like Ramses the Great, Thutmose the Third, Akhenaten, Tutankhamun. They're all from this period. So this is when the text dates to, or at least the examples that we have. And we have examples from a couple different tombs of the kings. It's probably an older text, though. Some people have looked at the language and think that it's possibly going back, you know, centuries before this. But this is where we have the best preserved examples. And it's a story about mankind. And it's a story about mankind rebelling. So the story opens up, says, "Then it came to pass that the majesty of Re, who came into being by himself, having been king of both mankind and gods, still together as one unity, while mankind plotted against the person of Re and his majesty. He had grown old, his bones become silver, his flesh gold, his hair of lapis lazuli." So we see that the king at this point, we're still dealing with a mythic time, where the king is overseeing the country, and he's still ruling the gods and mankind, who are still mixed together. Now, he's become this kind of semi-precious individual, right? We're dealing with, you know, bones of silver, flesh of gold. Lapis lazuli is a very prized you know, precious stone in the ancient world. Has like a beautiful kind of blue color to it. So the king is old, and mankind is plotting against him. So he brings together a council of gods, and he says to them, "Summon to me my eye, as well as the fathers and mothers who were with me when I was in the noon, and also the god Noon. Bring his courtiers along with him, but bring them secretly, lest mankind see and their hearts flee. Come with them to the great place, so that they may give me their counsel. For in the end, I may return to the noon, to the place where I came into being." So here we see that Re, who's ruling over mankind, is really quite pissed. So he wants all of the gods and all of these proto-gods to come and to give him counsel. So for a second here, he talks about the god Noon, and he says that he may return to the noon. So we need to kind of focus on that, because that's really important. So the noon is the time before creation. The noon is characterized as dark, chaotic waters where nothing is existing. Nothing is existing until the god creates himself. And then he goes on to create other gods. And in some examples of the story, because we have different versions of Egyptian creation myths, in some of the stories, we have gods who are there helping him. In other stories, he creates himself and then goes on to create other gods. But these are the gods that he's bringing with him. And what he's saying is he may decide to return to those chaotic waters. And that's going to be the destruction, really, of the entire world and of the cosmos. So he may just decide to simply end creation. So he has all the gods brought to him in secret. He doesn't want mankind to know. And so he goes in and all the gods are there talking to him. And he addresses them and he says to the noon, right? This god who personifies the chaotic primordial waters. "O eldest god in whom I came into being, and you ancestral gods, behold, mankind who came into being from my eye is plotting against me." And this is actually an interesting bit of wordplay here. They say that mankind comes forth from his eye. And this is actually some punning, and we see this a lot in ancient Egyptian texts. The word for cry is remi, but the word for people or mankind is remech. So here we have that wordplay where you know men are thought of as coming forth from the tears of the god, and that's where those two words and why those two words are linked. And the Egyptians very much seem to have the idea that if words sounded alike, they were somehow linked at a cosmological level. And many of the stories we have pull these aspects in together and have this type of wordplay. So he tells all the gods that they're plotting against him. And he says, "Tell me what you would do about this. Since I am searching, I seek not to slay them before having heard what you might have said." So he's very clearly here aiming towards destroying mankind. They're rebellious, but he wants the Noon's advice. And Noon replies, "Oh, my son Re, greater than his maker and more august than his creators, be seated on your throne. Great is fear of you when your eye is on those who conspire against you." To which the majesty of Re replies, "See, they have fled into the desert, their hearts being afraid that I speak to him." And then the gods, kind of as a chorus, say to Re, "Send out your eye that it may smite them for you. Those conspirers of evil, no eye is more fit to smite them for you. May it come down as Hathor." Now, this is a really interesting kind of point. So they all agree we're gonna punish mankind. We're going to destroy them. And send out your eye, which is Hathor. Now, the Eye of Re is a title that actually we see goes to lots of different goddesses. And they're seen as these kind of protectors and punishers who will punish evil and who will protect the god. And they eventually kind of become personified by the Uraeus that sits on top of the king's crown, that snake, that cobra with pointing out that's supposed to spit fire at his enemies. This is one of the personifications. So here they call down Hathor. And Hathor we normally think of as a goddess of love and of fertility and of sex, but she's seen as the most powerful and the best goddess to undertake this mission. And so the goddess goes. She chases mankind into the desert. And so the goddess returns after slaying mankind, and Re says to her, "Welcome in peace, Hathor, I who did what I came for." And the goddess says, "As you live for me, I have overpowered mankind, and it was a balm to my heart." So she's overpowered mankind. She's punished them, and it made her feel good. And Rey replies to her, "I shall have power over them as king. Hold off diminishing their number." So Rey is satisfied with the slaughter. She's diminished them, but Hathor's not done. And the text reads, "And so the powerful one came into being." Now, again, this is somewhat wordplay, because powerful one in Egyptian is Sekhmet, which is actually a different goddess. She's a goddess whose name literally means a powerful one, and she's a fierce lioness protector goddess. And so Hathor essentially at this point is slaughtering mankind. Rey says, "You've done enough. Stop diminishing them." But she doesn't. She essentially enters into this kind of bloodlust battle rage and becomes Sekhmet, who's often associated with battle. So now, who's going to stop this powerful goddess? They don't have a way to do it. So what we see here is that Rey says, "Summon to me speedy messengers who run like a body shadow." And the messengers are brought to him, and he says, "Run up to Yebu and fetch me red ochre in great quantity." And red ochre is just like an ink. So these messengers, who are super fast, come and they bring him huge amounts of red ochre. And at the same time, he has maidens crush barley for beer. And he adds the red ochre to the beer so that it looks like the blood of men. 7,000 jars of this beer are made. And then the majesty, the king of Upper and Lower Egypt, Rey, comes together with the gods to view this beer. And at this time, the goddess Hathor, or Hathor becomes Sekhmet, is traveling to the south. So he conspires with the gods, and he says, "Carry this beer to the place where she plans to slay mankind." All the gods go, and they flood out a field with 7,000 jars of beer. So when the goddess sets out in the morning, she sees these fields inundated with what looks like blood, and she's delighted to see this. She goes and she drinks all 7,000 jars of beer. She then returns, but she's so drunk that she doesn't recognize mankind. And then Rey says, "Welcome in peace, O beautiful one." And he says to the goddess, "Let sleeping drafts be prepared for her on the seasonal festivals of the year, and let this be entrusted to the maidservants." And the text goes on to tell us, "And since this day, the custom came into being that people entrust the preparation of sleeping drinks to the maidservants on the feast of Hathor." What we see here is a tale where Hathor, at the order of the king, goes to destroy mankind. And when Rey changes his mind, she can't be stopped. The only way they can figure out to stop her is to get her super drunk. She then becomes happy. She becomes pacified. Mankind is saved, and they go on to commemorate this event through a feast. And this leads us back full circle to the festival and drunkenness. So here, every year, at least once a year, the people then partake in the seasonal feasts of these strong, you know, sleeping draughts, which are really, you know, alcohol, where they're getting super drunk as a commemoration of this event, where mankind was actually saved. Now, as I said before in the beginning of the podcast, this appears to be a wide-ranging festival. And festivals really were the time when most ancient Egyptians would have participated in religious events. Most ancient Egyptians wouldn't have been able to even enter the temple proper. But these type of festivals were made to incorporate everyone. They were really communal events. So here we see that this festival is something that would have brought the community together, in addition to commemorating this myth. Now, some of the more interesting things are some of the inscriptions associated with it. We have one that actually says that we have young women who are associated with the lion goddess, right, with Sekhmet / Hathor. They have floral garlands in their hair. They serve alcohol, and it's supposed to be a really kind of sensual environment where people are beating drums, where we see priests carrying a likeness or a representation of Hathor. And then it comes to one of the more controversial aspects of this. And controversial, I would say, not necessarily for the ancient Egyptians, but for those of us who are studying it. And that's the issue of sex. The ancient Egyptians were all about the idea of fertility and renewal, right? Take Osiris as a good example. He dies. He's brought back together. He's given a magical penis that continues to operate. That's how Horus eventually is born. But that death and fertility is a cycle. Just like the yearly flooding of the Nile is a cycle. It's a cycle associated with fertility and renewal. And it seems that this festival typically would have occurred just as the Nile waters began to rise. So sometime we're dealing with the middle of summer, you know, probably about August. That's when the Nile would actually start to flood, because the flooding of the Nile is the result of the monsoon season that happens in the summer in the Ethiopian highlands, which are where the blue and the white Nile, two of the tributaries, kind of gain some of their water, and then eventually, as they go on and merge, swell the banks of the Nile proper as it runs through Egypt. So we see from some of the textual evidence around this that there might be a strong sexual component. There are pots that seem to be associated with this ritual that say on the pots, let them drink and let them have sex in front of the god. We have another text that goes on that says, I remember visiting the ancestors, and when I went, anointed with perfume as a mistress of drunkenness, traveling the marshes. And this is kind of interesting, because traveling the marshes is actually an ancient Egyptian euphemism for having sex. While this is written a bit later, that text I just read is written around 900 BC, we actually see they're making sexual allusions. And much later, in the Greco-Roman period, we actually have individuals who seem to maybe gain their parentage during this festival. We have a priest who identifies himself as being kind of conceived in this context. And we see a number of people who refer to themselves in the kind of interesting way as orphans who are gifts to the temple. Now, this could simply be people who were orphaned, their parents couldn't afford them, and they were kind of, you know, given to the temple to provide service. Or it's speculated by scholar Betsy Bryan, who's an Egyptologist at Johns Hopkins, who specifically has done a lot of research on this, that these may be individuals who were kind of conceived during this festival. There is some interesting evidence that Betsy has looked at that shows that many in society might have actually frowned upon this, that the idea of, you know, consuming alcohol, of making them lose control, that would not be seen as something that was necessarily proper. We would see that the whole Egyptian setup is all about order emerging from chaos. And the idea is that this alcohol is making them lose that control, just like Hathor lost control and become Sakhmet. So there's this kind of balance of, are they really wanting to lose control? You know, they're kind of skating to the edge with this festival. So there you have it, the festival of drunkenness in ancient Egypt. This huge, apparently widespread festival where individuals are drinking, they're carousing, possibly engaged in public, you know, acts of sexuality, all in celebration of the prevention of mankind's destruction. Well, I hope you found it interesting, and as always, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit ericsguidetoancientegypt.com. If you liked this episode, please don't forget to leave a review on iTunes and Stitcher. We'll catch you next time.